The two gay men who were assaulted last year in Center City, Philadelphia, have taken the stand in the trial of Catherine Knott. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The testimony highlights one often overlooked aspect of a criminal trial, the toll the process takes on victims who are often forced to relive traumatic events. As the trial continues this week, WHYY's Bobby Allen talked to one longtime friend of the men who says the trial has been grueling.
To know how the men who were assaulted feel right now is hard to say because the judge has issued a gag order preventing Andrew Hout and Zach Hess from talking to the press. But one of Hess's childhood friends and current business partner, Karen Kunkel, says watching in the courtroom is not easy.
It's very difficult to have to reopen proverbial wounds again after a year of having some time to heal and rest.
The attorney for accused perpetrator Catherine Knott has questioned Hout and Hess on the stand. Kunkel says there's a psychological component to that.
He's, you know, trying to trick him, coming closer to him. So that's an intimidating thing because, you know, as a victim, you would associate the aggressor's lawyer with the aggressor. So even their lawyer coming up and close to you and saying, oh, I need to touch your piece of paper is a scary thing.
Kunkel can't help but be taken back to memories of visiting her friends in the hospital.
So Zach is telling me, you know, they did this because we're gay. And the confusion and the sense of bewilderment on his face, and he starts crying and he says, and girls were hitting me too.
Kunkel says she and Hess went to a Christian high school and were raised in a community in which values and sexual orientation can often clash.
They're not exactly going out and embracing, you know, the gay community. Neither is the high school that Zach and I went to. But the overwhelming response from our Christian community has been, it's not okay to be hurt for who you are.
The trial of Catherine Knott continues this week. Two other defendants in the case avoided jail time by accepting plea deals. If convicted on aggravated assault and other charges, Knott could face years in prison. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
If you live or work in Philadelphia, you likely have experience with the city wage tax. Only a few municipalities impose a local income tax like Philadelphia does, and now a U.S. Supreme Court decision this year is throwing such taxes into question. Let's try to get answers to our questions from WHYY Plan Philly transportation reporter Jim Saxa. Jim, what's the essence of the court decision?
What this court decision did was it said that taxpayers that live in a jurisdiction that taxes both income from where you live and income from where you earn it, that puts those people at a risk of a double taxation. What that does is it potentially violates something called the Dormant Commerce Clause, which essentially says that states are not allowed to prefer in-state commercial activities over activities that cross state borders. So the basic example is a tariff. States can't provide tariffs. In this case, the risk of double taxation creates a preference for in-state activity over interstate activity.
Where then would this apply?
The most prominent area around here is for Philadelphia residents that work in New York. If you live here, you're paying the Philadelphia wage tax, but you're also paying income taxes to New York. And without a credit, which Philadelphia currently does not offer, that sort of tax would likely be found unconstitutional.
This decision came down in May. We're near the end of the year. Why has it taken so long to gain traction? And have there been any cases based on the decision?
One of the reasons why it's taken so long is that it's a sort of complicated area that only affects a certain amount of people. There is already, though, a court case working its way through the Philadelphia tax appeal system. The administration could be doing something more proactively. They don't know how much is this going to impact the city budget. And unlike some other jurisdictions like Kansas and Iowa, they haven't issued any sort of public tax guidance on how to deal with the implications of this court case from May.
So is there even a general sense of the implications for Philadelphia?
What we can say at this point is that this is going to cost the city budget millions of dollars, perhaps tens of millions. The Kennedy administration, as they're coming in, they say that they're working on the problem, they know about the problem, and they're trying to figure out what the impact is. But at this point, without that sort of inside information, it's basically impossible to say.
How can we get a sense of whether a case would be successful?
I asked Ruth Mason, who's a professor of law at University of Virginia. She said that the Maryland tax in the Wynn decision, the Supreme Court decision from May, essentially has three taxes. There's one for people that live and work in Maryland, two for people that live in Maryland but work elsewhere, and three, people that are living elsewhere and working in Maryland.
And this combination of these three taxes with no credit for taxes assessed by other jurisdictions was found to be, by the Supreme Court, to be unconstitutional as a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause. And the Philadelphia tax operates identically to that.
So what's the solution?
Well, the easiest solution would be for the city of Philadelphia to provide a credit for Philadelphia residents that are paying an out-of-state income tax. So if I live in Philadelphia, work in New York, I should get a credit on my Philadelphia wage tax for income taxes that I am currently paying to the state of New York. Notably, this probably would not have much impact on the Philadelphia resident who works in New Jersey, because we have a reciprocity agreement.
Jim, what's the possible or likely timeline for this Philadelphia case?
For the current case, it could take upwards of a year or two to finally get to a decision. And if the city decides to appeal that decision, it could take another two or three, maybe even 4 years. That being said, the Kennedy administration, if they so decide, could proactively address this issue and start providing credit beforehand.
But for whatever duration it goes on, if it's found in favor of those who have been taxed twice, they will enjoy a refund dating back to when the Supreme Court case was decided.
Exactly.
Jim, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Jim Saxa, WHYY Plan Philly transportation reporter on NewsWorks tonight. Turning to this evening's headlines, Philadelphia Mayor-elect Jim Kenney selects Sozi Pedro Tulante to be the next city solicitor. Kenney says he wants to improve the climate between city council and the solicitor, who's also supposed to advise council members in legal matters.
He wants the solicitor's office to be a change agent, to be an advocate for things, and to move the city forward, not just, as I used to call it, the Department of No, which is going to be the Department of Possibilities.
Tulante says he spoke or visited with every member of council before his appointment was made public. New Jersey Republicans introduced a plan they say shores up a fund to pay for road, bridge, and other infrastructure work without raising the gasoline tax. State Senators Jennifer Beck and Michael Daugherty introduced a 7-year proposal at a news conference today. Democrats say raising the gas tax is required. Hunters would be banned from importing or exporting big game trophy animals through New Jersey airports and ports under a measure moving through the legislature. Lawmakers say the proposal comes in response to the killing of Cecil, a Zimbabwean lion whose death sparked protests over the summer. The Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia is offering $5 million in grants to researchers and institutions studying water quality in the Delaware River. The Natural History Museum, affiliated with Drexel University, says the questions they hope to answer include how climate change is affecting the river, what contaminants are flowing off farms, and whether current technology can deal with these issues. Also, some of New Jersey's representatives in Washington want to revive a tax to pay for cleaning up polluted sites. Senators Cory Booker and Bob Menendez, as well as Representatives Frank Pallone Jr. and Bill Pascrell, have proposed legislation they say will ensure polluting companies and not taxpayers foot the bill for cleaning up polluted sites. 64 degrees, it's 6:15. You're listening to NewsWorks tonight on WHYY. This evening's forecast, the chance for showers and then gradual clearing overnight, low 56. Tomorrow, sunny, breezy, Tuesday's high 63. Still ahead.
I just had a book of my family I always keep in my purse, and our passports, which were taken at the Jordanian border.
NewsWorks tonight continues on WHYY.
Suites at Lankenau Medical Center support WHYY. Complementing Lankenau Medical Center's commitment to quality patient care, the suites are designed with their patients' privacy and well-being in mind. Each suite features private living and dining areas, personalized amenities, and concierge services. Designed to be warm and inviting, the Barbara Brodsky Suites provide a novel option in private hospital accommodations. To take a virtual tour, mainlinehealth.org/Brodsky.
A whole bunch of the high-tech products we know and love are made in China, in part because the government there is pretty competitive.
I think Li Keqiang is basically trying to shame his people into not being complacent. And he wants them to step up and innovate, which I think some companies are doing.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Innovation, China, and the decidedly low-tech ballpoint pen. The story next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight starting at 6:30 this evening. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Things have changed for the people who resettle refugees in the United States and their clients, even in states like Pennsylvania, where the governor is supportive, unlike most. Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty reports from the city of Lancaster, which is a hub for refugees.
Hello.
That's Farhan Al-Qadri.
Salam wa rahmatullah.
Hey, dude.
Well, alhamdulillah.
Great. Let's go. Okay.
He's talking to his friend who's giving him a ride to work at Espen Shade Farms in Lancaster County, where Farhan's been cleaning machines for $10.50 an hour. This new job's a far cry from the successful warehousing business that took him 3 decades to build in his native Syria. Right now, we're in Farhan's row house on Prince Street in downtown Lancaster. It has 3 bedrooms, 1 bathroom, the paint's peeling a little bit, and above the door, there's a sign that says, "Live simply, live well." Farhan explains how 3 years ago, he was doing well enough for himself that he and his family were living in a 20-room house with a courtyard in the middle and plenty of land, just outside the village of Dara.
We were not expecting to leave. We did not want to leave. Not to Jordan, not to any other country. We really did not want to leave. But one day in August of 2012, around 70 or 80 mortars exploded near our houses in our village. So the children were scared, and my wife decided to take them across the border to Jordan.
Farhan's wife is Muna.
I just had a book of my family I always keep in my purse, and our passports, which were taken at the Jordanian border.
Farhan, Muna, and 4 of their children are among the 600 refugees that resettled in Lancaster last year. That's a lot. The city has 70,000 residents and gets more refugees than Philly, Pittsburgh, or any other Pennsylvania city. In fact, it gets more than 20 states. Sheila Mastro Pietro runs the Lancaster affiliate of Church World Service, one of the country's 9 refugee resettlement agencies. She explains why Lancaster is a hub.
Low unemployment, social services, cheaper housing, and an accepting community, and the number of churches here. Because we're church-based, we try to resettle families through churches.
But what if the unwelcoming attitude of other states lands more refugees in states like Pennsylvania, seen as welcoming? After the Paris attacks, 19 governors, including Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, said refugee resettlement should continue, as is. Most others said they don't want newly arrived Syrians as residents. The federal government says states can't directly prohibit entry by refugees, Syrian or otherwise, at least not legally. In Pennsylvania, 3/4 of the state Senate supported a resolution to stop resettling Syrians pending a review of screening and security measures. And
funding is a huge concern.
That's Susan Fratsky, policy analyst and program coordinator at the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. This is how resettlement funding works. The federal Department of State cuts checks directly to the resettlement agencies for the money each refugee gets for living expenses during their first few months in the U.S. Beyond that, support like food stamps, career mentoring, or English language instruction, all of that is paid for mainly by the National Office of Refugee Resettlement, which passes the money through state governments.
the state government would have the ability to withhold those funds or refuse to accept them. And that could cause problems to the operation of the programs on the ground. And then, of course, mean that refugee resettlement agencies might consider not locating someone in a state that said that they are going to do that, because it would be a much less welcoming place for that person, and that person wouldn't have access to the support they need.
That hasn't gone on yet. And resettlement tends to happen in places with the capacity and will on the local level to welcome refugees. Resettlement agencies say that as images flooded the internet of Syrians fleeing and sometimes dying in the process, interest in helping them surged nationwide, including in Lancaster. Mastro Pietro says support has been overwhelming, but there's been some negative feedback about resettling Syrians in Lancaster, mainly through anonymous voicemails or comments on online news stories.
Maybe it's because they're not identified, or maybe it's because Lancastrians support refugee resettlement, or the people who don't support it don't know where these people are or who they are.
Farhan and his family were apprehensive at the prospect of going to the United States.
My anxiety is that I have daughters from a Muslim country. So there is fear that because they are Arab, maybe there will be harassment, cursing, and words not good for girls in school, in the streets, because they wear the hijab.
But Muna says they've been pleasantly surprised.
I don't speak the American language, but I notice that they smile, and it's comforting because they are very human.
Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads, Lancaster.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focused on Pennsylvania cities, their problems, and potential solutions. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. Tonight's waxing crescent moon ensures dark skies, although cloud cover will hamper the ability to catch the gemmed meteor shower at its peak. Let's make the best of it with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, let's talk about the gemmeds.
This is a really great shower. In fact, it has now become the most prominent shower of the year. When this shower was first identified back in the 1850s, it was only 20 meteors per hour. That's not a whole lot, considering that the standard background rate for any night is 10 meteors per hour, so it wasn't very significant. But since the 1850s, the Geminids have come on as the primary meteor shower of the year, with a clear, dark sky hourly rate of 120 meteors per hour. Now, these are slow meteors, yet they do have a few fireballs available. And the most unusual thing about this shower is that unlike all other showers, or most other showers, the material does not originate from comet debris. Instead, in this case, the debris that makes up the meteors comes from an asteroid. So we're actually seeing bits of material probably left over from the interior of a planet that used to be in this solar system billions of years ago.
As we consider manned flight and perhaps an eventual trip to Mars, let's take it all the way back to the beginning. Kitty Hawk, North Carolina.
Well, on Thursday this week, it'll be 112 years since the Wright brothers made their historic flight of a powered flying vehicle. From that point, not far after that, came government contracts for delivery of U.S. mail. And as that business grew, passengers began to fly along with the mail. Now, if we look at the pattern of development of commercial space access today, we can see a similar pattern developing. There are currently some providers that are interested in and actually are developing the capability to fly ordinary people into space, but that hasn't come about just yet. What they're doing is they're providing supplies to International Space Station, very much like the mail service that grew out of the Wright brothers' accomplishments.
Another date on the calendar marks the last time that a man walked on the moon.
It's 43 years ago, actually today, that Gene Cernan became the last human to walk on the surface of the moon. Gene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt had been on the moon for 3 days. And in that three-day period, they had spent almost 24 hours out on the surface of the moon, collecting rocks and examining the soil and exploring all over. But it really was appropriate that Schmitt could be there on that very last mission, because Schmitt was actually a geologist. Interestingly enough, as the astronauts come back into the lunar module, the spacesuits they walked around in on the moon
also brought with them a considerable amount of lunar dust. Now, I had a really wonderful experience about 10 years ago working on an exhibit for the Franklin Institute about space exploration. I went to do some research about lunar spacesuits. I had to go to the place in Sweetland, Maryland, where those spacesuits are kept, the original lunar spacesuits. And Dave, I have to tell you, it was an extraordinary experience. The most prominent thing that stood out was the amount of moon dust still on the suits. But the smell of the lunar dust is very much like that of what you smell from a burnt match head. And I really relish the idea that molecules of moon dust were interacting with my brain such that I could identify a smell and in my own way come in contact with the moon.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up without a space ways incorporated.
Finally this evening, it may be 60-plus degrees outside, but that isn't stopping Pennsylvania officials from getting into the winter holiday spirit. A 22-foot-tall Douglas fir is decorated for Christmas and fully lit in the rotunda of the Pennsylvania Capitol in Harrisburg. Governor Tom Wolf and First Lady Frances Wolf hit the switch during a noontime ceremony today, illuminating the rotunda tree and others outside of the Capitol's main front entrance, as well as in nearby Soldiers Grove. The tree is among 28 located around the Capitol complex, thanks to the state's Association of Christmas Tree Growers. They'll be in place until January 11th. The rotunda's tree is from a farm in Lehighton, Carbon County. Pennsylvania has some 1,400 Christmas tree farms, producing around 1 million cut trees per year on 31,000 acres. Governor Wolf says his Christmas wish is for a state budget, a document that's now nearly 6 months late. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. An all-red Starbucks cup is seen by critics as the latest salvo in the so-called war on Christmas. And tomorrow evening, we'll explore the beginnings of controversy over religious symbols, which just may surprise you. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
The Cooper Heart Institute supports WHYY. Their multidisciplinary team of cardiologists offers the Watchman device, an innovative, minimally invasive treatment option designed to reduce the need for long-term blood thinners in patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation, thereby reducing the risk of AFib-related stroke. The Cooper Heart Institute is a comprehensive heart care center with offices throughout South Jersey. Details at cooperhealth.org/watchman.
We're going to take it from them.
Yes, sir.
Seize it.
Yes, sir.
The new film, Beasts of No Nation, is about young boys forced into being soldiers serving a warlord in an unnamed African country. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the film's director, Cary Fukunaga, who also directed the first season of True Detective. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM.
International Ballet Exchange presents the Donetsk Ballet in their return to the Philadelphia area for two performances of The Nutcracker. The performances will take place on Saturday, December 19th at 6:30 p.m. and again on Sunday, December 20th at 2 p.m. at Plymouth White Marsh High School in Plymouth Meeting. Ticket reservations and complete information are available by phone at 1-800-849-4919 or online at internationalballet.org. International Ballet Exchange supports WHYY.